We're in Colossians chapter 2 for our study this morning. Colossians chapter 2. C.S. Lewis warned us. He wrote, "If you do not listen to theology, that will not mean that you have no ideas about God. It will mean that you will have a lot of wrong ones." Now, we've been studying theology. That's what the book of Colossians starts out with. And theology is one of those things that sometimes we get bored over and we think, oh, I remember as a kid going to church and snoozing through the sermon. Some of the sermons I remembered in the church that we went to when I was a child. It's like, oh my gosh, theology, that's got to be the snoozing stuff. C.S. Lewis warns us, if we don't pay attention to good theology, to good study of who God is, doesn't mean that you're not going to have any ideas about God. It means your ideas will probably be wrong. So we want to pay attention to good theology. And that's what we've been talking about. This morning we're going over to the dark side. We're going to study bad theology this morning. I've been telling you that one of the issues of why Paul wrote to the Colossians was to deal with heresy. So this morning, brace yourselves. I will give you a primer on Gnosticism. Talk to you about Gnosticism. Let's see if the first one comes. There we go. We're up and running. Historically, the roots of Gnosticism began about 100 years before Christ. It doesn't start after Christianity. It started before Christianity and got woven into Christianity. The Gnostic perversion of Christianity would take hold around 100 A.D. We think that it might have entered through the city of Colossae, who he's writing to, and it would begin to flourish into the 200-300s A.D. It would eventually be wiped out by the Middle Ages. It would just disappear. But it's back. Gnosticism has raised its lovely head over the last few years. I don't know if you saw the book or saw the movie or read the book. Maybe you saw the book and read the movie. I don't know. The Da Vinci Code. It was woven very quietly throughout the movie and, in fact, in the book. In fact, they made the subtle claims that what we would call a heresy was actually what Jesus wanted. This was what the church was supposed to be like. And it's only because they've come up with something new, and everybody likes something new. Actually, history tells us something far different. There are ancient Gnostic texts that are beginning to get into the bookstores. There was the Gospel of Thomas that kind of became a wonder a little while back. The Gospel of Judas was the one that hit last year, where they've come across these ancient manuscripts. It's raising its ugly head. So this morning I'm going to give you a little bit of a primer of what Gnosticism is all about. But first, I want to give you a warning about our desire for something new. I don't know about you, but I like new things. You know, if I have a choice between driving an old car and a new car, I'm sorry. I'm not one of these guys who wants to drive an old car. I want to drive a new car. I don't know about you. I mean, if I had a choice. You know, if I know my computer's only about a year old, but if you offered me a newer one, I don't know that I would say no. I'd like new. I like upgrades. I want the bestest, the fastest, the newest. You know, as long as it's got new on the package, we like that, don't we? I mean, that's what we want. People are always curious about finding something new or something that's secret. In reality, there's very little that's new, especially when it comes to theology. It's just reworked old stuff. many of the old garbage that we're gonna study about this morning is what's simply coming up today and being remanufactured as new. Be careful about wanting something new. Sometimes I wonder if the reason why we want something new is because I don't like the old. You know, the old gospel that tells me I'm a sinner. I don't want people to tell me I'm a sinner. The old gospel that tells me I need to trust in Jesus. I'd rather trust in something else. Beloved, we need to be careful about this hook about the new stuff. Now, Gnosticism itself, one of the main ideas of Gnosticism is that all material things are evil. Everything you touch and feel and see and smell, that's all the evil stuff. And spirit things are what's good. So everything that you can touch and see is evil. Everything that you can't see, that's where the good stuff is. Now, that's a fundamental idea at the root of Gnosticism. Let me give you a Gnostic glossary. I'm going to give you your own handy-dandy Gnostic glossary, a guide to the code words of Gnosticism. The reason I want to do this is that as I've been studying this for a couple of weeks, and what's fascinating, you can just go to Wikipedia and look up Gnosticism. And if you can stomach reading through the thing, they give you the glossary. I'm not making this up. I got this off of Wikipedia. So it's got to be right, right? It's on the internet. What I found fascinating is that as I began to study it, I began to look at these things and I was thinking, wait a minute, that's the word Paul used over here. Wait a minute, this word he uses over here. And as I started going through this list of stuff that they gave of terms in Gnosticism, I became fascinated and realized, oh my gosh, we as English readers don't, it goes right over our head. But when you're reading it in the original language, in Greek, Paul's very carefully dealing with these issues of the Gnostics. And we talk about this stuff, this is the way cults work. They will use the same language you and I use, but they will use the words in a different way. Our friends who go to the Jehovah's Witness, it's not a church, what do they call it? Kingdom Hall, there you go. When they talk about Jesus, some of us, our eyes light up and we go, all right, they're talking about Jesus. Yeah, I know him. The problem is, it's a different Jesus. No, it's the same Jesus. He uses the same name, spells his name just the same, J-E-S-U-S. No, when you look at who they're talking about, it's a different one than the one described in the Scripture. Paul warns us about following after another Jesus. Our friends in the Mormon church, they will use words like salvation and redemption. And we think about these two lovely young men in their white shirts and bicycles at our front door, and we think, yeah, I like Jesus too. Yeah, I want to be saved. Yeah, you talk just like my church. And in fact, the Mormon church more and more is talking more and more like regular fundamental Christian churches. But their definitions are different. So see, they let your guard down by using the same words, and then they bring you into something that has twisted the truth. So Paul is going to deal with the same kind of a thing with what was at that day the big threat, Gnosticism. So I'm going to give you six words that will help you, just give you a little taste of Gnosticism. First word is gnosis, or gnosis, gnosis. That looks like the word Gnostic, doesn't it? Well, yeah, because that's where it comes from. It comes from this word. The word means knowledge. That's the key to Gnosticism, is knowledge, knowing the right stuff, having a special kind of knowledge. That's what's important. See, everything we've talked about, everything that you see and touch, that's the evil stuff, you know, spirit things are good. And with the right kind of knowledge, if you have the right kind of secret handshakes and rituals and knowledge, then we can help free that little nugget of good inside of you and free you from this evil around you. That's the idea behind Gnosticism, having special secret knowledge. And that's what makes you eternal. Paul uses this word all through his letter. In Colossians chapter 2, verse 3, he says, talking about Jesus, he says, in whom are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and gnosis. No, the knowledge that you need is not in some secret book that meets behind, some secret group that meets in a secret place with secret handshakes. The knowledge you need is in Jesus. Very, very simple. You need Jesus. He's going to say this over and over. Second word, very important word, pleroma. Pleroma. Now repeat after me, class. Pleroma. Listen, you say it now. You say it. Pleroma. Okay. That's what happens when your band goes to Italy. You play Roma. I like second service. You laugh at my jokes. First service just looked and go, huh? Pleroma. Pleroma means fullness. Now, to the Gnostic mind, this is a code word about God. The ultimate God, the best God, they call the Pleroma. The Pleroma describes all of who God is. It's described as a region of light that's different from our evil material universe. They had other code words, too. They would call God, the light. They would call God the one or the monad or the complete eon or the deep or the light. Another related term to this in Gnosticism was the Godhead. They called the Pleroma the Godhead. Another way of referring to this more perfect God. The Gnostics taught that the fullness was so perfect that it could have nothing to do with this evil material world. Paul uses this word. We saw it in chapter 1, verse 19. For it pleased the Father that in him, that in who? That in Jesus, all the pleroma should dwell. Paul says, no, it's not something that's so far away that you can never touch it. No, the Father put the fullness in Jesus. It's all found in Jesus. The fullness is found in Jesus. Another one to see their secret words is the word eon or aeon, or the Greek is actually ion, like I own a Honda. The word means eternal. The word means eternal. Now, this is not a thing. This is an it. This is a person. The Gnostics taught that these were beings created by emanations from the Pleroma. What's an emanation? There's lots of things that are emanations. When you just, I just drank some of my Monster, some of the bubbly stuff comes up and out comes up. An emanation. It could be something like that. When a mother has a baby, that's like an emanation, something that comes out, you know. And so the Pleroma had burps, and out came these creatures called eons. Each eon would create further eons. Now, do you remember these pictures from a few weeks back? Well, I've showed this series several times. Each one gets a little more inferior. So you start with a better eon, and he creates a lesser eon who's a little more evil, who creates another one who's a little more evil. And in fact, their idea was that the bottom of the rung was the God of the Old Testament. So the God of the Old Testament in our picture is Mighty Mouse. Okay? But he is the one who is evil enough to create the universe, the physical universe. He's the one that's flawed enough. Some of them called this God satanic. So how does that hit you? Calling Yahweh satanic or Satan. It's like, oh my gosh. You think they're a little off?
Yeah.
Paul used this word, aeon, eon, ion. He used this word to talk about the mystery of Christ coming to the Gentiles, the mystery that Jesus would dwell in our hearts. He wrote Colossians 1:26 that this mystery, which has been hidden from eons and from generations, but now has been revealed to his saints. Now, our translation says it's been hidden from the ages, from all eternity, the secret that Jesus would actually come and save Gentiles and that Jesus would actually live in your heart. But it's kind of interesting because he sticks their word in there. It was hidden from these eons. Interesting. Fourth word, Sophia. Anybody have a friend named Sophia? Sophie? Okay. The word means wisdom. So your friend named Sophia, her name means wisdom. And if she's your best friend, or you're her best friend, then you are Sophie's choice. I was trying to get that one in. For the Gnostics, Sophia is a female goddess. Sophia is a female goddess. And she's like the second to the last rung down. She's the one who gives birth to Yahweh. So you didn't know this, did you? You thought that God always existed. Not really. That's because he lied to you. Because he's so evil. Actually, he had a mom named Sophia. That's Gnosticism. Paul uses this word Sophia 6 times in the book of Colossians. He uses it often to describe Jesus. Colossians 2:3. We already saw this. In whom are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. Sophia is not a her. It is wisdom. And it's found in Jesus. Wisdom. It's found in Jesus. See, Paul takes their terms and he clarifies it with truth. Fifth word. The Greek is demiurgos. This looks like demiurge. That's something that you order at Starbucks, like a demi-toss. This is a demiurge. I'm not fully urging this. I kind of only half urge this. This is, okay, stop. I'll stop. The word means a skilled laborer. And the Gnostics use this term for the title of the son of Sophia, who is Yahweh. So they call Yahweh, the God of the Old Testament, they call him the demiurge, the skilled laborer, the bottom of the rung. The writer of Hebrews, I was curious about this. This is one of the words that sold me on the fact that I got to tell you guys about this stuff. The writer of the book of Hebrews is the one that uses this word. I was curious because I hadn't come across this word in Paul's writings. And so I did a search of the Greek New Testament, and I found the writer of Hebrews uses this in Hebrews 11:10. It says, and it's talking about Abraham here. And it says, he, Abraham, waited for the city which has foundations, whose builder and maker, demiurgos, is God. Now, the writer of Hebrews is talking about how Abraham had his eyes fixed not on an earthly city, but on heaven. And heaven's maker is God. Now, they would say that this demiurg is the guy who made only the physical universe. The writer of Hebrews says, no, he made heaven. He made heaven and earth, not just this flawed, wicked world. Demiurg. Last word is the word archon. That's what happens when you get gas at Arco. Trying. I'm dying up here, pal. Don't nod at me. The word means, archon means, word means beginning, or we find it translated often principality. The Gnostics used this term to describe lesser beings who were created by the demiurge, the bottom of the rung. This guy, you know, Mighty Mouse makes lesser beings that they would call angels and demons, and that they're the ones that actually control everything. Okay? Paul uses this word as well, Colossians 1:16, for by him all things were created that are in heaven and that are on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or principalities, archons, or powers, all things were created through him and for him. Now, it sounds to me like they pretty much got this one right. But Jesus is the one that created them. They were created by Jesus, these archons, these angelic powers. And in fact, we're going to see later that he actually is the head of them. He rules over them. Okay, let's get into Colossians chapter 2. We're ready for our text. Got your terms down? Now, we can speak Gnostic to each other. No, don't. Chapter 2. Verse 8. Paul says this, beware lest anyone cheat you through philosophy and empty deceit. The word he uses for cheat, it means to rob and lead, to carry off booty. Makes me think of pirates. Arr! Watch out for pirates. There be pirates here. In the Greek, there's what I would call a helping verb that's not clearly translated. It's the word to be. Watch out lest you, and it's future tense. He's saying you will be led away. You will be robbed by pirates. The word he uses is also singular, which means there's a person coming to Colossae who's going to deceive all of you. He's warning them. Watch out. Open your eyes. There's someone coming to deceive you. He says, through philosophy and empty deceit. The word philosophy has Sophia in it. It's the word love plus Sophia. Phileo plus Sophia. To love wisdom. That's what philosophy is. It's a love of wisdom. And I don't think Paul's saying that all philosophy is wrong. Not at all. He's not saying that. There have been some great Christian philosophers and thinkers. C.S. Lewis, Francis Schaeffer. Wisdom, or the love of wisdom, is not wrong. Jesus is all about wisdom. Paul's already written, we saw it in Colossians 2:3, in Jesus are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. So wisdom's not wrong. Philosophy is not wrong. This June, start making some plans for summer. Some of you ought to think about coming on Thursday nights just for the summer. We're going to be doing a 13-week series that Focus on the Family has put out called The Truth Project. And it's a series of videos that they put together. They're all about an hour long. And we will be showing the videos. We will be sitting around and discussing it afterwards for a little while. There's 13 of them. And it's a lot of it is philosophy. There's some that talks about science, history, apologetics, understanding why you believe what you believe. You should know why you believe what you believe. Awesome stuff. My son David and Greg Berg went through the training, and they've already watched all 13 videos, and they're just blown away. I mean, my son just got the coolest things that he's been learning from this thing. It's awesome. Philosophy is good. It's good to understand why, but Paul says there is some bad juju out there. There's bad stuff out there, and you better watch out, because this bad stuff is going to be like a pirate, and rip you off. Some wisdom is nothing but empty ideas. Paul writes to Timothy, O Timothy, guard what was committed to your trust, avoiding the profane and idle babblings and contradictions of what is falsely called knowledge. There is stuff out there where people will turn your head around and make you all dizzy with their silly arguments. And because we haven't done our homework, we don't know how to respond to them. Well, Paul says, watch out. They're going to try to cheat you. They're going to try to rip you off with this stuff. He says, verse 8, according to the tradition of men. The word that he uses for tradition, paradosis, means a giving over, a passing on. And that's how tradition works. It's something you pass on from person to person. And some traditions are good. Paul even writes to the Thessalonians, therefore, brethren, stand fast and hold the traditions which you were taught, whether by word or our epistle. There are some traditions that are good. You know, opening presents on Christmas. I like that tradition. Does anybody like that tradition? I like that one. I vote that we keep that one. That's a good thing. You know, it's okay. Getting me chocolate every once in a while is a good tradition. I think you could do that. You know, there are some traditions that are good. Nothing wrong with tradition. Some are good. Some traditions can cause problems. This word paradosis is many times used to describe a work that we know now, we call now as the Mishnah, the oral tradition. You see, many of the Jews don't believe that the first five books of the Bible are all that Moses got from God when he was up on the mountain for 40 days. You know, the book of Exodus, we just went through that. Remember that? And some think that, well, 40 days and 40 nights, and that's all he got? Was it just these couple books? No, he must have got more than that. And so things had developed over time through history, passed down from rabbi to rabbi, were never written down initially. Until about 200 A.D., Rabbi Ben Yehuda, or I think his name, something like that. I remember visiting his grave in Israel a couple years back. He was the famous rabbi who took all of these things that were passed on by word of mouth, and around 200 A.D., he wrote it all down. It's now a six-volume work, and it's called the Mishnah. This is the stuff that Jesus, this thing, this Mishnah, was the thing that Jesus was constantly concerned about with the Pharisees. when he talks about the traditions. Look at Matthew chapter 15. Look at Matthew chapter 15. Matthew chapter 15. Verse 1. Matthew chapter 15, verse 1. It says, then the scribes and Pharisees who were from Jerusalem came to Jesus saying, why do your disciples transgress the tradition of the elders? And they're talking about this stuff in the Mishnah. For they do not wash their hands when they eat bread. Now, they're not talking about germs. You and I think, well, why would Jesus have a problem with that? Those bad disciples, didn't their mothers ever teach them? You know, maybe they should at least take some Purell hand cleanser with them when they don't have any water. I mean, you know, just, you know, it's sanitary, guys. Where have those hands been? Ooh, you know, it's not what it's about. This is not about germs. This is about ceremonial cleansing, cleanliness. They thought that washing your hands in a certain way made you better with God. And so there's this whole ritual in the Mishnah about how you wash your hands, about how much you're supposed to take a half of an egg cup, half of an eggshell full of water, and you pour it over thusly, and then you pour it over thusly, and you rub your hands in the prescribed manner, the certain number of times has to drip off of your elbows, and all this kind of stuff, all to follow this certain rituals. In the Mishnah, it says, whoever eats bread without washing of hands is as if he lay with a whore. What? Isn't that a little overboard? That's tradition. That's tradition. Verse 3, Jesus answered and said to them, why do you also transgress the commandment of God because of your tradition? For God commanded, and he switches the subject just a little bit, but he stays on the idea of tradition. He says, for God commanded, saying, honor your father and mother, and he who curses his father and mother, let him be put to death. That's what God says. But you say, whoever says to his father or mother, whatever profit you might have received from me is a gift to God, then he need not honor his father or mother. Thus you have made the commandment of God of no effect by your tradition. Now, what's he saying? See, there was a loophole the Pharisees had discovered. The Bible indicates you ought to honor your parents. And sometimes that means when they get a little bit older, you ought to help take care of them. And so, see, I got this money market account. And it's, I've kind of been building it up, you know, for the day that I could take my wife to Hawaii or something like this, you know, and I'd be kind of saving this money. But my mom runs into some tough times. Not to worry. I can just promise to give this money to God. God, I give you my money market. Now, I'm going to hold on to it just in case. But I'm going to give this to you. Sorry, Mom, I can't help you out. Everything I own belongs to God. Then I got my loophole. And Jesus says, you've used tradition to rewrite God's word. Danger. Problem. You got a difficulty. You got something wrong going on here. Some traditions can cause problems. The Roman Catholic Church has a difficulty built into it. The Catholic Church, the Roman Catholic Church, teaches that church tradition is as important, is equal to the Bible. And there's a little difficulty with that. That means that if the Pope declares that Mary is your co-redemptrix, that Mary is able to save you, even though the Bible says you're saved by Jesus dying on the cross and you trusting him, well, but if the Catholic Church says this, this becomes tradition. And therefore, if you're Catholic, you need to believe that. That's the way the Catholic Church has set itself up. That it can say things that are as important as the Bible. If the Pope declares that, no, you don't receive grace by faith. You receive grace for salvation by doing things like going to church. So you're lucky today. Actually, you're not lucky because you're at the wrong church. You're in big trouble. Big, big trouble. Now see, there is a problem built into this theology that says that tradition is as important as the Word of God. Jesus is rebuking the Pharisees over the same kind of an issue. You need to have God's Word be the priority in your life. You can be cheated through tradition. And so Paul is warning them, watch out. Don't let anybody cheat you through philosophy, empty deceit, according to the tradition of men. And then he says in verse 8, according to the basic principles of the world and not according to Christ. Now, the word he uses for basic principles, it's the Greek word stoicheion. It means first of a series of things. It can refer to elementary things like the letters of the alphabet or the periodic table of elements. When you take the elements are called stoicheion. The ancient Greeks used this word to refer to the elemental spirits of the universe, the angels that influenced the heavenly bodies. It was one of the main vocabulary words of people following astrology, the stoicheion. They're the ones that control the whole thing. You ever wonder, you know, how did the stars do this? You know, if I read this horoscope, how does all this thing come about? Well, the Gnostics would tell you that there are angelic beings who control all this stuff. And they've got the secrets to it. Paul warns the Colossians against demonic heresies that will lead them away from Jesus. Beloved, as Christians, you ought to be concerned about things like horoscope. It's demonic. You might think it's harmless. You might think like, well, it's just a joke. I just wanted to see what it's going to say today. Be careful, beloved. There is something real behind it. It's demonic. Things like Ouija boards. I remember as a kid playing with a Ouija board. Anybody else play with a Ouija board when you're a kid? You know? Oh, man. Oh, my gosh. Who moved that thing? Well, maybe it was a joke. Maybe it was your brother. Maybe it was, you know, something like that. But there can be demonic elements in stuff like this. Christians who dabble in this kind of stuff are only asking for trouble. Paul says you could get cheated by this stuff. Verse 9. So watch out for this stuff because it's going to cheat you. It says, and he says, for in him dwells all the fullness of the Godhead bodily. A couple, four words I want to pull out. The word for dwells, important. It means to settle, to inhabit, to be at home with. In him, there, at home in Jesus is the fullness of the Godhead. I don't know if anything's starting to jump out at you, like that word fullness, pleroma. Again, he says, in Jesus, the pleroma is at home in him. He says the pleroma of the Godhead. There's another one of those code words. It's in Jesus. And it says it dwells in him bodily. Wait a minute, I thought the Godhead, I thought the pleroma was something so distant it could never have anything to do with us, the material things. And in fact, Paul says, no, it's even at home in Jesus' physical body. Now, this raises an issue. There is a heresy called docetism. You're getting all kinds of just $100 words here today, all for free. Oh, but you can amaze your friends. Docetism is a doctrine among the Gnostics and other goofy things. And Docetism teaches that Jesus did not have a physical, earthly body. It's more like that. More like Casper the Friendly Ghost. You know, if you walked up to Jesus and wanted to pat him on the back, you'd go right through him. You know, if you're kind of leaning against him, you know, it just like you'd fall right through Jesus. You know, if he was to eat anything, you'd watch it go right and drop on the floor. You know, it's just because he's a ghost. If he walks on the beach, he doesn't leave footprints. That's what Docetism teaches. And yet Paul says it dwells in him bodily, physically. John, who would also deal with Gnosticism, writes, And every spirit that does not confess that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh is not of God. And this is the spirit of the Antichrist, which you have heard was coming and is now already in the world. The Gnostics could never believe that a holy God could live in physical flesh, but he did. And Paul says he was even at home. He was even at home, put his feet up and watched the TV, you know. It's just, he's just right at home in Jesus. Paul says in verse 10, he says, "And you are complete in him who is the head of all principality and power." Can you guess what principality word is? It's that archon thing, you know, that you go to Arco, whatever. He says, "In him you are complete." The word that's translated complete, I'm sorry if I'm spinning your head with too many Greek words, but this stuff is just fascinating. The Greek word is pleroo. It means to make full, to make complete in every particular, to render perfect. The verb, the form of the verb, is what's called a perfect participle. This means it was done in the past, but the results continue into the present. And the way a Greek perfect passive participle of pleroo looks like, the actual Greek word is pepleromenoi. Sounds a little bit like pleroma, doesn't it? Oh no, not pepperoni, sorry, but pepleromenoi. But it sounds like that pleroma. I love the way Paul, it's like he's doing little word plays in the Greek. He says, and the fullness, the pleroma, is in Jesus. And if you got Jesus, it's in you. That's even worse for the Gnostics. I mean, it's one thing if it's in Jesus, maybe we could explain that away. But now it's in you? The Gnostics might think, well, we will be complete one day after we get out of this physical body. But Paul says this has already happened, past tense. It's already happened. See, he's ripping all of their foundation out from underneath them. He's making it very clear. It's funny. I came across, when I was studying the Gnosticism garbage, I came across these Christian theologians who say, well, actually, Paul's the one who started Gnosticism because he uses their word. No, pay attention to what he's saying. He's ripping it out from underneath them. He's making it very clear. He's using the words and clarifying the truth. Now, it says in him, you are complete. One lesson. If you think of one thing from this morning, I hope it's this. Jesus is all I need. Jesus is all I need. You know what? Could you say this with me? Jesus is all I need. Listen to yourself and say it again. Jesus is all I need. That's what Paul's saying. Now, don't get me wrong. I still need some other stuff. I need to eat. I will need a cheeseburger after this, you know, something like that. Or maybe pepperoni pizza, right? Pepperoni pizza. I'm going to need some other stuff. Don't get me wrong. And there are some things I need to do in life. But the bottom line, gang, let this sink in. In Jesus, you are complete. Yeah, but. It's the yeah buts that get us into trouble. Do I really need this other thing? Do I? Paul says, you are complete in him. You could say it this way. When his fullness is in me, I am full. Pleroo, full, complete. I think we can get led astray when we start thinking I need something else. When I stop thinking that Jesus is all I need. Well, I need Jesus, but, you know, I need this little fix right now. Watch out. Watch out. The Amazon River is the largest river in the world. The mouth of the Amazon is 90 miles across. That's how big it is. There is enough water to exceed the combined flow of the Yangtze, Mississippi, and Nile rivers. Combined. There is so much water coming from the Amazon that they can detect its currents 200 miles out into the ocean. That's a Google map. This is it's hard to see. The river comes out here. Here's the mouth of the river. And all this area, it's lighter colored stuff in the ocean. That's the delta. That's the outflow. Satellite images of the river. One irony of all this is that sailors in ancient times sometimes died for lack of water, caught in the windless waters of the South Atlantic. They would be adrift, helpless, dying of thirst. Sometimes, other ships from South America who knew the area would come alongside and call out, "What's your problem?" And they would exclaim, "Can you spare us some water? Our sailors are dying of thirst." And from the other ship would come the cry, "Just lower your buckets. You're in the mouth of the Amazon." So what is it that you need? Unsatisfied? Jesus is all I need. Oh, what a marvelous truth. Gang, spend some time this afternoon thinking on that. Just lower your buckets. Verse 11. Two more verses and we're done. Verse 11. Paul says, "In him you were also circumcised with the circumcision made without hands, by putting off the body of the sins of the flesh by the circumcision of Christ." Huh? Okay. Circumcision, the Greek word means to cut around. Circumcision, I'm not going to show you pictures, sorry. Circumcision, so, you know, you can look up there, but you're not going to see that picture, sorry. Circumcision was a ritual that started with Abraham, Genesis 17. It involved the cutting around of a certain piece of the male anatomy. You can look it up online if you really need to know. It was supposed to be a sign between Abraham and his male descendants and God. It was supposed to be a sign that we are following God. So, see, the story goes, there's these five houses of religion in a small Florida town. There's the Presbyterian Church, the Baptist Church, the Methodist Church, the Catholic Church, and the Jewish synagogue. Each was overrun by pesky squirrels. One day, the Presbyterian Church called a meeting to decide what to do about the squirrels. After much prayer and consideration, they determined that the squirrels were predestined to be there, and they shouldn't interfere with God's divine will. The Baptist Church. In the Baptist Church, the squirrels had taken up habitation in the baptistry. The deacons met and decided to put a cover on the baptistry and drown the squirrels. But the squirrels escaped. Arr, some of them were pirates. And there were twice as many there the next week. The Methodist Church got together and decided that they were not in any position to harm any of God's creation. So they humanely trapped the squirrels and set them free a few miles outside of town. 3 days later, the squirrels were back. The Catholic Church came up with a good solution. They baptized the squirrels, registered them as members of the church, and now they only see them on Christmas, Ash Wednesday, Palm Sunday, and Easter. Not much was heard from the Jewish synagogue. They took one squirrel and had a short service with him called circumcision. And haven't seen any other squirrels on the property since. Circumcision was always intended to paint a picture. The picture of living a life not after the flesh, but after the Spirit. a man identifies with Abraham and God's call on Abraham when he cuts his flesh away and chooses to live for God. That's what the picture's supposed to be. In fact, the picture was always intended to be of something deeper, not just this actual thing. Moses wrote, this is, you know, thousands of years ago, back in the beginning, in Deuteronomy chapter 10, Moses writes, Therefore, circumcise the foreskin of your heart. Be stiff-necked no longer. The real issue was supposed to be a heart issue. The actual ceremony itself was a physical thing, but it's supposed to remind you of something to take care of in your heart. Paul says, in him you were also circumcised with the circumcision made without hands. The word made without hand means not hand to make. It wasn't done by the hands. Now, see, the Gnostics were big on ceremonies, really big on ceremonies, rituals. We would call them, here's another $50 word, you're going to love this one. We would call them sacramentalists. Sacramentalists. Oh, that's the governor, sacramentoists. Sorry, they were called sacramentalists. There we go. In other words, they thought that secret magic ceremonies were the hot ticket. Like circumcision, that'll be a secret magic thing. But Paul says it's not literal circumcision. It's the spiritual one that counts, the one without hands. Paul is saying that as a believer in Christ, something has happened to you. The power of sin has been cut away from your heart. There's potential here. You don't have to do what you're wanting to do. You don't have to. You've been circumcised with a circumcision without hands. That's what happens when Jesus is in your life. Now, sometimes you say, well, yeah, but I want to do it anyway, so I'm not paying attention to you. And I go and I do my thing. But you don't have to. You don't have to. Verse 12, he says that you were buried with him in baptism, in which you also were raised with him through faith in the working of God who raised him from the dead. Now, a couple significant words. There's one word that's translated buried with, and it's the word, and the word is, it's a compound word. It's the word with and the word buried. You're buried with somebody. That says like, oh, really? Okay, he's really smart today. But see, the idea is that you're not buried by yourself. You're buried with someone. And that somehow baptism connects you to Jesus, and what he died, somehow something of you died as well. In fact, you were buried with him. He says, you were buried with him in baptism. And the word baptism means immersion, submersion. The Jews actually practiced, this is new for me, I learned this year, when we went to Israel. The Jews actually practiced baptism before Jesus. Baptism is not a Christian thing. We kind of get a little confused. When John the Baptist showed up on the scene and he started baptizing people, he didn't say, now, let me explain to you what I'm going to do. No, they knew what he was going to do, what they were doing. Because the Jews had this conception that baptism, getting dunked in this water, somehow was related to having your sins washed away. The temple in Jesus' day had built-in baptismals. We would call them mikvaot. The singular is mikvah. They had several of these mikvah. The plural is mikvaot. And they had several of them right there at the entrance of the temple. In other words, you could come and get a bath before you went in to worship God. In fact, we were warned, weren't we, on one of my trips. Was this our trip? No, we didn't do Hezekiah's Tunnel. When we went to Hezekiah's Tunnel a couple years ago, they warned us, you better be careful because there are some religious Jews that, because Hezekiah's Tunnel is a water tunnel. And there are some places where the water is about this deep, and so you're going to have to be careful because you may stumble across some naked Jewish men. Luckily, we didn't. It's like that would just like ruin the whole thing. But they still practice this ritual cleansing. In Jerusalem, they've discovered in some of the ruins, in these large houses dating back to Jesus' day, one of them we went through that they thought might be connected to Caiaphas, might have been Caiaphas' house. The guy was so wealthy, stinking wealthy, he had his own built-in mikvah, a built-in bath for ritual cleansing. At Qumran, where they did the Dead Sea Scrolls, out in the wilderness, this desert of the Dead Sea, they had built their own baptismals. And in fact, we saw in the film at the Dead Sea that that John the Baptist was connected to all this. He had spent time at Qumran. Also, just as a little side note, baptism has always been intended to be full immersion. I know that some practice the little dry cleaning thing, the little sprinkle thing, you know. And, you know, I appreciate that. Don't mean to ridicule or anything. But the idea of baptism is to get completely under, to be completely immersed. I'm not trying to say that your baptism is right or wrong. That's not my point. That's not my point. I'm just trying to get you historically correct. He says, you were buried with him in baptism, in which you also were raised with him. Now, the word buried with was a single word, buried with. Now, here it says, it's a single word, you were raised with. You were buried with, you were raised with. Somehow, baptism connects you with Jesus. When you get dunked in the water, that's supposed to be a picture of you dying with Christ. And you go all the way under, dead and buried. And usually, the pastor is nice enough to bring you back out. Now, some of you I've held under a little longer than others. But we still bring them back up. And you bring them back up, and that's a picture of being raised from the dead. There's a symbolism there. There's a picture there. You were raised with him. And it says, you were also raised with him through faith in the working of God. He mentions faith. That's how it happens. That's the vehicle through which we have this new life. We are saved by grace through faith. You were not saved by the ritual of baptism. Not saved by baptism. You are saved by trusting in Jesus. Baptism simply is the picture that shows everybody what has happened to you. You are saved by putting your trust in Jesus Christ, in the working of God who raised him from the dead. Last thought. We are complete through death and resurrection. Verse 10 talked about us being complete in him. Here's one of the ways we are complete in him. Paul says there's been a change that's taken place. Something has died. Something has come alive. There is a sense that our death with Christ has removed the power of sin from our lives. God's made it inoperative. It doesn't have to have its strong death grip on you anymore. It doesn't have to. There is a sense that our being raised with Christ gives us strength to live for him. In other words, Jesus changes lives. When you come to Christ, things change. Your life changes. Some of it will be you picking up the ball and doing some things right. Yes, absolutely. But gang, it starts with him changing you. Does anybody know what I'm talking about? Does anybody know what I'm talking about when I say that Jesus changes lives? Would you say that Jesus has changed your life? Let me see hands. Yes, he has changed our lives. There might be some of you who wonder about that. You're not going to know till you give your life to him. He will change you. He will start this work in you. I've got people that I'm agonizing for. I wish, because they've got some huge issues in their lives. You know what? It comes down to this. You need Jesus, right? They need Jesus. They need Jesus. We are complete in him. Let's stand and pray.